There is a new mantra that we carry with us in the College of Arts and Architecture, relentlessly encouraging our faculty and staff and students who are here tonight to climb higher and to dream out loud. It is, I think, what gifted artists do best as they transform impossibility into being, as they render through the language of movement, style, and expression those feelings and thoughts that evade the written word, as they translate the fluidity of the mind into the structure of a song. As a child, I remember hearing Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 and listening in awe as one of my favorite childhood songs, Frère Jacques, was slowed and shifted into a minor key to completely change the mood from festive to funereal and back again. I realized in that moment that the composer carries with them the power to revive parts of the mind and the heart that the challenges and humdrum of everyday life can deaden and desensitize. That moment of wonder led me to explore all 9 of Mahler's symphonies, and later all 9 of Beethoven's. Tonight's speaker, too, among his long list of accomplishments as a lecturer, scholar, composer, presenter, humanist, and collaborator, counts 9 symphonies among his repertoire of works that have touched the ears and souls of millions. 9 symphonies. To me, Eric Funk epitomizes the artist's persistent soul, creating composition after composition, each seeking to reveal a new layer or unwitnessed dimension of human existence. 4 operas, 6 ballets, 3 large works for chorus and orchestra, 19 concertos, works too numerous to mention for solo instruments and voices, and a musical pedigree that began at the age of 2 have ensured that Eric Funk's talents have nourished us with 67 years of beautiful music. We are fortunate and all the better as humans and appreciators of all things creative that Eric has shared 16 of those with us at Montana State University as a colleague of the First Order in the School of Music. His generosity as a musician is illustrated not only in how he conveys his own stories through music, but how he recognizes the importance of letting others share theirs. His Emmy Award-winning PBS program, which most of you know, 11th and Grant, now in its 13th season, has given a range of talented Montana musicians, many of them MSU faculty, a platform to perform and to dialogue about the intricacies of their practice. It's a program that speaks to all Montanans as Eric equally finds finesse and facility in speaking about music with accomplished peers and colleagues from around the world. The Bozeman visitor waiting at the baggage claim at our airport and experiencing their first taste of Montana culture with him. Or the curious student who doesn't know that they love music yet. One of 575 students he routinely teaches each semester in his American Popular Music and Masterworks classes. Eric's work is not only recognized by his colleagues here in Montana. Eric Funk's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, Opus 71, won the 2018 International Global Music Award, main prize, and was a double gold medal best in show in the categories of classical music and composition. Imagine Eric's Vili, Concerto for the Violin Alone, Opus 109, a piece written for Hungarian virtuoso Vilmos Ola, in which all the parts usually performed by the orchestra are performed instead by one single solitary violin. Now an award-winning PBS documentary entitled The Violin Alone, Funk's work was awarded not 1, not 2, not 3, but 6. 2018 Emmy Awards for Best Music Composition, Best Cultural Documentary, Best Director, Best Photography, Best Editing, and Best Audio. The documentary was also declared Best Documentary at Chicago's prestigious 2017 AmerCord Art House Television Awards. His works have premiered globally with prestigious ensembles, including the Warsaw Philharmonic and the Latvian National Symphony Orchestra. They have also been performed 2 at Carnegie Hall in New York City. The quiet sophistication and civility of Eric's practice was also recognized when Charles Osgood showcased him on CBS Sunday Morning in 1998 following a feature story written about him in the New York Times. He has been honored with a Montana Governor's Award for the Arts, a Montana Arts Council Humanities Hero Award, and at Montana State University, the James and Mary Ross Provost Award for Excellence in Teaching, a President's Excellence in Teaching Award, and a Distinguished Service Award from our Honors College. Given this level of global engagement, Eric is frequently asked why he doesn't base himself in New York or LA instead of Montana. His response as the son of two talented musicians is earnestly simple and straightforward. I make sense here. So, and this is where I'll have to try to not be verklempt. Much of what you can appreciate about Eric is on his website, outlining the many performances, creations, and journeys that make him the absolutely extraordinary man that you will see he is tonight. But I want to share with you something about Eric that transcends the unquestionable accomplishment of his bio. Eric Funk is a friend whose amazing successes have never clouded his humanity and his generosity. On one particularly stressful day, which a dean occasionally has, I remember serendipitously receiving a text from Eric where he said, "I'm proud to be on your team, Royce. Don't ever be discouraged, no matter what. We keep on keeping on. And to be honest, the integrity of our team inspires me to do so." In Eric's world, as you can see, success is not only a function of personal accomplishment, but an unwavering belief in the power of teamwork, collaboration, and the constant support of others. To return to my first experience of Mahler's Symphony No. 1, I cried that day. What I affectionately came to know later in my life is my Mahler moment. But I didn't really understand why I cried. Something had spoken to me, moved me on a visceral and soulful level. It was not a sadness, but a deepness. When I sat at my desk and focused on this evening's distinguished speaker and the myriad of ways in which he has contributed to the vitality of our world of music, I feel as though I understand those feelings I had as a child much better. As a dean, there is no greater gift than to share with the world and with all of you the accomplishments of their talented faculty and to extol the beauty inherent in a creative life so richly and fully lived. It gives me infinite pleasure to do just that this evening. Please join me in welcoming the amazing and talented, one of MSU's finest, Mr. Eric Funk.
So I should just leave now, I think that. Not wanting to miss a teaching moment, I thought it would be interesting to start the way that I start my classes here. As Royce pointed out, I deal with a lot of students every semester. And typically what I do is I'll take a nursery rhyme like Mary Had a Little Lamb or Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, play the melody, and then I'll play it as if Mozart wrote it, and then as a jazz tune and a country tune and a rock tune. And basically what I'm trying to relay to them is that when they say they like a particular kind of music, what they're really saying is they like the delivery methodology. And so any melody and harmony can be just refashioned and become something else. So I thought in the spirit of that, to warm the room up a little bit, I would start by playing for you a piece that was written by Rodgers and Hammerstein for the musical South Pacific, and the tune is called This Nearly Was Mine. But what I'm going to do with it is play it as though Chopin wrote it. Thank you. I was afraid Royce had stolen my speech because some of the things he said you're going to hear again. But I wanted to craft this, and I was kind of torn between reading this to you or actually improvising it, which is what I usually do in the classroom. But I thought this was tight enough, the way that I wrote it, I could get through everything that I wanted to in the time that I have allotted. It's quite a bit of information to cover. So I'll begin. I love music. I love everything about it. I love all kinds of music. I am passionate about it. Every class I teach, every performance I give, every work I conduct, every show I help produce, and every piece of music I compose is filled with energy and measures of that love and passion. Additionally, I've always valued those people with whom one feels better for having been around. I've worked hard at becoming one of those people, and I've tried to treat every encounter as if it were the most important encounter of my life, including my interaction with students and colleagues. Any success I have had in my life seems to stem entirely from these things. I'd like to express my deep appreciation for the honor being bestowed on me by Montana State University by inviting me to be part of the Provost Distinguished Lecture Series. I was asked to speak about myself and about my life, which I'm certainly willing to do and something I hope will be of interest to each of you. However, like most of you, I was raised with a firm understanding of the importance of humility. Toward that end, I'd like to point out that my life has largely been the art of harvesting the many opportunities that have come my way, making the most of every gift given, sometimes needing to ultimately turn adversity into advantage. A central part of my learning and action over the course of my life has been to move the gifts of circumstance to full advantage. We each fashion a life over the course of our time on earth. We try to create something with integrity and purpose, life's work through which we might make the world a better place. We create our own lives. I tried to set the plow blade deep and move slowly. It's important to be able to periodically turn around, look back, and view our life, and sense no stone left unturned. If one is fortunate, elderhood can be the most amazing part of life. That's the plan. I was very fortunate to have been born into a musical family. Both of my parents were professional musicians and educators. As it turned out, all four of us, my brother and two sisters and I, all became professional musicians as well. It's no surprise then when it came to making the decision with regard to what I wanted to do with my life that it was driven by the inner question, which aspect of music would you like to pursue? It was my world as far back as I can remember. My parents were professionally trained opera singers and music educators, my father a composer and conductor as well, my mother played piano and flute. I started performing publicly with my two older siblings when I was 2.5 years old. The three of us had a fairly rich repertoire of songs. Family legend has it that I was the one with the powerful memory, my elder brother and sister often looking to me to resolve forgotten lyrics. Later, as part of fundraising activities for my dad's professional choirs, our family performed two-hour concerts, singing 4 to 6-part a cappella songs, sacred and secular, and then presented various styles of music in small duos and trios, each of us four young people playing 2 or 3 instruments. It wasn't uncommon for us to be awakened in the morning with one of our parents singing, "It's opera day!" This meant that we had to sing every word normally spoken from that point forward. The breakfast table requests for cereal, milk, and toast were all sung. Attempts to get into the bathroom to ready for school were particularly rich. Fervent scenes of improvised recitatives and arias, duets of argument and pleadings before heading out the door for school with a stage exit singing, "See you after school, have a good day." By the way, in the 4th grade, it was a little embarrassing to discover that it wasn't opera day at school. It was only at our house. I have 5 major hats that I wear as a musician. I compose music, I perform music, I conduct music, I teach music, and I present music as an artistic director, host, and music producer. As a composer, I create something akin to blueprints for sound sculptures. That's part of my music. That part of my musical life is alive with sound on the internal plane. It's my raison d'etre. I've spent thousands of hours over my lifetime involved deeply in what might appear to onlookers as continued total silence, but in my mind, it's alive with sound. It's symphonic. As a performer, I launch music into the air with the full force of my understanding of that which the composer intended. I am an interpreter seeking to fashion and exact that which was once only alive in the composer's imagination. My purpose in that world is to manifest someone else's dream onto this plane. As a conductor, I'm doing much the same thing as that which I do as a performer, but I remain silent. In that role, I am shaping the music that others perform. I am, for example, taking Beethoven's or Mozart's or Prokofiev's music as it appears in the music score on paper and making certain that the ensemble I'm leading achieves the most perfect replica of what the composer intended. As a teacher, it is my duty and joy to share my understanding of music with students of all ages. I have often used the analogy that I get to take them on hikes to the most beautifully singular aural places, and once in the midst of it, help them understand what they are hearing. And I get to be part of revealing that music isn't merely a commodity and entertainment, but in fact, as art, the radar of the human spirit, something akin to the soul itself. As a presenter, I showcase other musicians and participate in platforms for them to perform and be heard. In some cases, I offer guidance for how to potentially more successfully achieve their objective as an ensemble, regardless of genre. My life is richly alive in the many worlds of music. I'd like to take a few minutes to go into more detail with regard to each of these parts of my life. Composing. First and foremost, as I mentioned earlier, composing is, I believe, my central purpose. It's the reason I'm on the earth. Some composers are born as something strangely equivalent to being a library filled with original music. I am one of those. As a little boy, I gradually started to realize that the music I was hearing in my mind, in my imagination, was not the music from the external world. Rather, this music was coming from inside me. The music I was hearing in my imagination was a different music than that coming from my parents singing or playing, or from the records they played, or music from the radio. I was hearing a different music altogether, sounds in my mind's ear. I use that term to reveal something similar to imaginings that we commonly refer to as the mind's eye. The mind's ear is sound, the mind's eye is visual. Some composers work this way. I've spent my life listening to music inside me, transferring it to the external world. Some composers approach the process differently, by using rhythms, motives, melodies, and harmonies, and then proceeding to develop those patterns. They invent new music by triggering their aesthetic preferences, resulting in new creations and thereby creating new pieces of music. There isn't one way to do this process. As I grew older, little tunes and harmonies started turning into full-blown pieces of music. Before I learned how to notate music onto music paper, I simply poked them out on the piano until I could play them, or I sang them repeatedly. Original music, it's there, inside the mind. It doesn't go away. I've spent the majority of my lifetime notating these sounds and double-checking for accuracy, making sure that what I placed on the page is as perfect a replica of that which I'm hearing as I'm able to capture. To date, it's resulted in 149 major works, including 9 symphonies, 19 concertos, 5 string quartets for operas, 5 ballets, numerous works for choir and orchestra or piano, and many chamber music pieces. This process might sound strange, but I expect that everyone here this evening might have at some time imagined a story. As you pay attention to every detail while the story unfolds in your mind, it affords everything you need to describe each character and describe the situations that emerge and braid into a clear plot. Ultimately, you need to sit down and write or type this story on paper. You're using words to convey through narrative the world you conjured. This is the same process as that which composers use. The major difference is that we composers use our language, the musical language, music notation. It's a representation of thoughts and ideas in sound, just as words are a representation of thoughts and ideas in language. I was very fortunate to have studied with 3 prominent Eastern European composers, each playing a critical role in my development as a composer. Tomáš Svoboda, Czech, Sándor Veres, Hungarian, and Krzysztof Penderecki, Pole. These 3 composers helped season my craft, refine the poetics of expression, and deepen my understanding of textures and densities, and relaying those qualities through orchestration. While working with each of them, I discovered a common trait they seemed to share. They each seemed to hold a fierce protection of the legacy of their knowledge, the torch of composition truth, if you will. They seemed to convey that they were passing on the treasured information from the past and needed assurance that it would be in good hands, would not be watered down or dumbed down in any way, but protected at the core with the same passion and accuracy the old masters transferred as a musical legacy. This was serious business. Between the three of them, the mentoring traces back to Bach, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Brahms, Liszt, Chopin, Dvorak, and other more obscure but critical and notable composers. Part of the challenge of being a contemporary classical composer with the kind of training I've had, in combination with the music I was born with looming inside, is that the music I compose is complex, not easily understood. When I encounter folks who candidly reveal that they just don't get the music I compose, I prefer to believe rather that they might not understand it yet. I say yet simply to point out that it's a well-known fact that many of the now beloved composers' music was not particularly beloved or valued in their own time. Rather, they were each highly criticized for changing the central core of that which is considered good music during the period which they composed. If you'd like to explore this more fully, you might enjoy reading Nicholas Lonimsky's Lexicon of Musical Invective, a compendium of harsh critical reviews dating back hundreds of years. Critics in his day, for example, said about Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, quote, "Beethoven couldn't write a melody if his life depended on it," end quote. If you were to read through the pejorative vilifications by critics during the lifetimes of these old masters, you would begin to understand that the music composers create is for another time, for the future, if it survives the test of time. As long as performers want to play a composer's music, it will continue to exist. Many of you might not be aware that Johann Sebastian Bach's music fell silent for some 93 years. If it hadn't been for Felix Mendelssohn, it wouldn't have continued to exist. As long as performers and conductors insist upon programming it, any composer's music will continue to live on. Bach's music was deemed too brainy by many. Even back in the 1800s, there seemed to be a general misunderstanding about art, adroitly captured by Allen Ginsberg in this quote. "There is still some hang-up that art is supposed to be at the service of the people, rather than individual expressions that mirror people's consciousness, but is the expression of a unique personal consciousness," end quote. My composition career remains promising. My catalog of work reveals a style that composer Alfred Schnittke called polystylism. It means that there is a lot of breadth and range in the kind of music I composed, from immediately accessible direct tonal works to complex non-strict serial chromaticism. Each piece demands its own expression and language. It would be difficult to know what my musical style is by listening to only one piece. The last 6 months have been rather breathtaking with regard to some substantial international and national awards and composition prizes. And just when I thought it couldn't get any better, I received a personal invitation from Krzysztof Penderecki to attend his 85th birthday celebration, a week of concerts of his music in Warsaw next month. While I'll be unable to attend, it is a true honor to have been asked to attend. Performing. In my life as a performer, for many years I performed professionally with a contemporary classical music high-powered trio called the Composer's Ensemble. Tomas Svoboda, composer-pianist, Brian Johansson, composer-guitarist, and me, composer-percussionist-singer. We did master classes, recordings, and performances throughout Oregon and Washington, featuring music we'd composed specifically for our trio, along with Baroque trio sonatas by Corelli, Vivaldi, and others, realized on piano, guitar, and vibraphone in place of the original scoring for harpsichord and two violins. I've also stayed active as a jazz pianist for over 50 years now, most recently performing at a reunion concert of my long-lived jazz quartet, Backburner, this past August at the Rialto. Prior to that, over the last 10 years, I performed frequently with my dear friend and renowned jazz bassist, Kelly Roberti, now deceased. As a jazz performer, I played mainly the piano. It's something I taught myself to do in my mid-teens. Simultaneously, I studied percussion instruments formally. I was a percussion major in college and worked professionally as a timpanist and percussionist with a number of orchestras in Portland, Oregon. I started playing guitar when I was 14. I recorded a couple of LPs on guitar, singing original songs I'd composed. I played drums in a rock band in high school and with a big band in college. And I played electric bass for 4 years in a top 40 band during the disco years. Gotta make money. I like all kinds of music and have performed and recorded music in most genres. But beyond classical music, jazz music is my favorite genre and at the center of my piano playing world. Improvisation, a form of extemporaneous dialogue in music, is at the heart of jazz. Pattern development in real time is the whole point. Building on small elements each composer used in their tune and or elaborating on what another player might have brought forward. It's gotten to the point now that it's difficult to discern when I'm improvising jazz and when I'm improvising contemporary classical music. I was again very lucky with regard to the musicians with whom I played. I seasoned my craft in the Northwest, playing alongside some master jazz musicians in a number of bands. I pieced together an income that included and often relied on my jazz gigs. In fact, I've made more money playing jazz piano than I have doing anything else in my career. I continued that part of my life when I returned to Montana in the mid-80s. As some of you might recall, I backed vibraphonist Terry Gibbs opening for Dave Brubeck at the first Jazz Montana concert in Bozeman long ago. I was also fortunate to play piano on a county fair tour behind Tennessee Ernie Ford, some of you may remember him, and be the piano player in pickup bands that backed the Supremes, Jim Messina, Gloria Loring, Trini Lopez, Roger and Roger, and other acts touring through the Northwest. Jazz piano started formally for me when I was an undergraduate student and was asked to play for a lunch hour in the Student Union building at Portland State University. They offered me $50. At that time, I was earning $12 a day driving a forklift at a wholesale tile and floor covering business in Portland, part of putting myself through undergraduate school. The money being offered to me for the lunch hour gig was four times what I was making in a whole day driving the forklift for 1 hour of work playing the piano. I agreed. But an hour before I was supposed to play, I went down to the cafeteria to see where the piano was and get a sense of the room. There were so many students there that I suddenly thought, I can't do this. Yikes. At least I can't do this alone. I went to the music building and walked through the practice room area. In one room, there was a student playing a double bass, sawing away with his bow on some etude. I knocked lightly, opened the door, and asked, "Do you play any jazz?" He answered, "Yes." I said, "Want to make $15? He answered, "Sure." On the way out, I noticed a drummer working rudiments on a practice pad. I knocked lightly, opened the door, and asked, "Do you play jazz?" He answered, "Yes." I asked, "Would you like to make $5? If we go pick up your drum kit?" He said, "Great." That little trio, which I named Jazz Confidential, a name I took from an album cover of one of my dad's records, played together for 3 years. I put myself through undergraduate school with the money I made playing gigs with those guys. We changed drummers and our name, calling our trio the In Crowd with two N's. That was the beginning. Now, more than 50 years later, I'm still at it. Teaching. I was in my early 20s when I began teaching music to college students. Music theory was my forte. It was ironic that I ultimately became the chair of music theory at Portland State University and that I became the boss of my then office partner and principal mentor, Tomas Svoboda. We were such dear, dear friends. I say ironic because I had taken music theory as an undergrad at Portland State. It was just awful. The teaching was dry and mechanical and rule-driven. I received A grades but couldn't find any relevance for the subject and felt it was more of a hoop through which I had to jump to secure my degree. After graduation, I became dedicated to and impassioned about the subject and just knew I could figure out a way to teach it that was thrilling, exciting, and applicable for any musician. It is, after all, both the chemistry and grammar of music. Understanding which notes are the nouns, which are the verbs, adjectives, adverbs, direct objects, etc., opens the world of music creation for composers and orchestrators and affords entry into more meaningful interpretation for performers and conductors. In a later teaching post at the Cascade campus of Portland Community College, I was dealing with non-traditional music students in a vocational music program. We had no budget. Part of my job was to teach sight singing to these young people. I secured multiple old copies of the Greater Portland Area Phone Directory to use as textbooks, taught my students to sing the phone numbers like they were degrees of the scale. 7716543. I called this approach aerobics. My students could respond anywhere on campus by me holding up fingers, indicating which pitches I wanted to hear. It worked. It was really fun. Those kids could sight read Schoenberg by the time I was done with them. I heard many people say, I've heard there's a very strong relationship between music and math. That is true. But there is also just a stronger relationship between music and literature, music and language, maybe stronger. Music is the language of the heart. It says that which cannot be said in words. I have taught so many students over the course of my life. Most of them were music students. But in the last 15 years, I've been given more responsibility for non-music students through Core 2.0 classes I teach. I have fashioned an interdisciplinary approach to offer an answer to the question, why do I have to take a music class? My major is X. Music has nothing to do with it. I wrote a book published by Kendall Hunt called Sound Thinking, It's All Music, How Music Connects with Everything. I use this for all of my cross-campus courses. Masterworks of Music, Classical, Enjoyment of Music, All Music and Western Civilization, and American Popular Music, A Reflection of Politics and Society. A commercial music over the history of America, necessarily including Native American music, gospel, spiritual, blues, ragtime, Dixieland, big band jazz, small band jazz, bebop, progressive jazz, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, folk music, country music, Broadway, film music, jazz rock, bluegrass, hip-hop, rap, spoken word, electronic house. It's an almost endless list, and it's growing. Students enrolled in my Masterworks of Music and Enjoyment of Music classes each write a major semester paper. The topic involves how their major and music are the same. The Enjoyment of Music students need to find the melody, harmony, rhythm, form, dynamics, tempi of their major or future workplace, like a hospital, or an office building, or a ranch. Deep listening is critical. Sometimes the sound, the music of the workplace, or the organizational problems that can arise in that space can be used to better diagnose and resolve problems more accurately identified through non-traditional approaches. These papers are so wonderful to read. In Masterworks of Music, students need to identify a problem in their professional field, transfer it to a problem in music, solve the problem in music, and then transfer it back to their discipline to see if that transform affords a solution otherwise not found. Speaking about this one evening with my friend Dr. Robert Maher, he brought up the process of using transforms to solve problems in electrical engineering. My approach simply relies more on interdisciplinary applications. Once the students realize that this is possible, they embrace my intention of using applied critical thinking approaches in an interdisciplinary curriculum through using unusual and critical alternative vectors of entry to complex problem solving. I love teaching. I believe that my palpable passion for the beauty of knowledge and the grace of learning excites student interest. I remain dedicated to teaching students how to think as opposed to what to think. I have to say that it's rather wonderful to be in the classroom after having served as both teacher and music department chair at three different colleges. I rather like these final years at the academy to be spent with just my teaching boots on. Conducting. The conducting side of my life has really been both exciting and fun. It all started me with telling my dad when I was 9 that I thought I wanted to be a conductor when I grew up. I asked him what I needed to do. In retrospect, I think he might have just been trying to get rid of me when he answered, memorize the 4 Brahms symphonies. I took him seriously and did that by listening endlessly to the Bruno Walter recordings of those 4 compositions. I stood on the piano bench in our music room and conducted to the recording with my tinker toy. Funny, decades later, I experienced a huge memory flashback while actually conducting Brahms' 4th symphony with the Helena Symphony. During the last movement, I suddenly was transported back to when I was 9, standing on that piano bench with that tinker toy. Professionally, my conducting career started with my formally studying conducting with Dr. Norman Layden, assistant conductor of the Oregon Symphony and former oboist with the New York Philharmonic under Toscanini. His doctoral dissertation focused on Toscanini's conducting technique, which I was taught. I also studied with S. John Trudeau, who had studied at the Pierre Monteau School. Monteau, the famous conductor of the world premiere of Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, or Rite of Spring, Paris, 1913. Inspiring my need to learn to conduct was having seen Stravinsky conduct the Rite of Spring when I was 17. It was amazing. I recall intuiting that as a composer I should learn conducting to be able to more expertly conduct my own works. And that's how my conducting career really began. I was mainly conducting my own compositions for orchestra, concert works, concertos, and a number of ballets. Eventually, my work as a conductor found me conducting the Latvian National Symphony in Riga, the New England Repertory Ensemble at Carnegie Hall, 5 years with the Gallatin Chamber Orchestra, an orchestra I founded here in Bozeman, and my 8 years as conductor of the Helena Symphony, which included those five magical Montana Power Summer Symphony concerts on the Carroll College campus, where some 10 to 15,000 people came to hear musicians from throughout Montana. For a number of years, I also conducted the Bozeman Municipal Band Tuesday nights at Bogart Park. That was an offshoot of my time as interim director of bands for our School of Music here at Montana State University. For a few years, I also served as interim MSU Symphony Orchestra conductor. There are a few memorable conducting performances involving my own compositions. One of those, when I was I conducted two brass quintets in the autumn outdoors on opposite corners of a full city block in Portland, Oregon. I had been commissioned to compose a new work for the inaugural celebration of the opening of Pioneer Courthouse Square. The event took place during the autumnal equinox in 1980. My work for antiphonal brass quintets was entitled Equinox. According to the Oregonian newspaper, an estimated 20,000 people stood in the center while my 10 brass players performed the 30-minute composition, which at the end involved the fortissimo sounds of all those brass instruments bouncing their beautiful brass sounds off the walls of buildings that surround the square. It was like tonal traffic noise. What a thrill. It's a humbling opportunity to guide any size ensemble through the process of actualizing any composer's sound sculpture, build it perfectly in the air, the music traveling through me and traveling into the air. It's even more exciting to do that with one's own music. In another instance, I was waiting to go on stage at Carnegie Hall. I was in the conductor's suite, something that was stirring in a different way. In that space are a number of very large posters, pictures of all of the conductors who've conducted there. Each has a personal handwritten message addressed to all the other conductors who might end up in that suite. We were just 30 minutes from the beginning of the concert. I was already in my tails, score in hand. But I found myself prompted and just had to stand in the shower stall with my score and baton, stand in the same spot that Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Toscanini, Bernstein, Ormandy, Zell, Ozawa, Metropolis, and so many others had stood. It was like being in the Parthenon. Even more thrilling was taking the stage with the 150 Montana children I'd brought there to perform the New York premiere of my composition From the Dreams of Montana Children. I'd been commissioned by American Composers Forum to write a piece celebrating Montana youth. I sent out an open letter to the principals of all Montana elementary schools asking them to invite their third and fourth grade students to draw or paint a picture of a dream they'd had while sleeping and then write a short description of the dream on the back. Over 1,800 pieces of art arrived at my door. I went through them, organized the written descriptions by subject, home, nature, family, nightmare, etc., and then arranged those written lines into a text that became the text of the piece of music. We did the official premiere at the Madison River Festival in Ennis with the Bozeman High School Camerata and our 150-voice children's chorus, kids from Ennis, Belgrade, and Bozeman. We hung the paintings in the lobby of the Ennis High School gym. Parents from throughout the state came to that concert and started their evening by first searching for their child's painting and then getting totally inducted into the child's world by simply walking through the gallery of children's art. We packed the house and had a standing ovation. That also happened in New York. We had a full house and a spontaneous standing ovation there. One of my favorite memories of that event was members of the professional symphony orchestra that accompanied the kids approaching me after the dress rehearsal and asking, "Who are these kids? Are they the best singers in Montana? This music is so complicated and difficult with all the key changes, tempo changes, meter changes. It's just amazing to hear them sing it with such ease." I smiled and replied, "No, these are just kids who wanted to sing this piece, regular kids from the valley where I live in a small town not far away." I told their teachers expressly not to ever tell the young musicians that the music was difficult, rather to simply expect them to be able to do it and teach them how. And they did, big time. I also loved reporting back to the Montana elementary school principals, asking them to share with their students that although they're sitting at a little desk in a little school in a little town in rural Montana, their thoughts and ideas can reach thousands and become a life memory for people far, far away. Presenting. In 2004, my jazz quartet Backburner did a Christmas special for Montana PBS called A Jazz Piece. It was a successful program and caught the attention of Gomez Ruthier, triggering his thought that a locally produced public television show featuring Montana jazz musicians would be a stellar idea to pursue. He and Lisa Titus invited me to lunch and pitched the idea. As lunch proceeded, we agreed that a program featuring professional Montana musicians in all genres would be even better. That concept has become our slogan for 11th and Grant with Eric Funk. All music, all Montana. This afforded an incredible platform for me to attempt to realize advice offered to me by my friend Hal Cook, longtime editor of Billboard magazine, the trade magazine for commercial music. Over the years, I'd invited Hal to be a member of the various ad hoc committees I'd created when I was serving as music department chairperson for different colleges. Over coffee one day, Hal told me, "Someone in every state should rake all the real talent to the center and produce and present it. This country is too big for record companies and other agencies to ever know what's happening in all the nooks and crannies." 11th and Grant afforded me the opportunity to do just that. Being a musician who plays both sides of the street, meaning I'm a classical musician and composer and a commercial music composer and performer, I had a certain credibility with musicians around Montana and knew so many of them already. Having been born in Deer Lodge, not at the prison, but just up the hill, having lived in Lewistown and Haver, having played baseball during summers in Missoula, and having grandparents in Bozeman and Deer Lodge, I hold a deep understanding of Montana people that also gives me an edge. These are the folks I've been around most of my life. Understanding this complex culture is essential if one wants to be involved in producing anything of value here. Bozeman, for example, is a baklava. Independent layers of community stacked on top of each other, existing simultaneously but oftentimes totally unaware of the other layers. It's an important thing to understand. Because my paternal lineage dates back to homesteaders in Gallatin Valley, I have a connection with the farming and ranching community. Because of my work as a musician and teacher in various worlds, I penetrate other layers as well. 11th and Grant with Eric Funk just finished shooting our 13th season. We now have 69 one-hour episodes. It's on the World Wide Web and can be viewed throughout the world. I receive fan mail from Germany, France, Japan, Poland, everywhere. A few years back, a new underwriter joined our ranks. He had watched the entire series to that point in Japan. We haven't reformatted this program to allow it to be purchased by other PBS stations in the U.S. like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Atlanta, et al., simply because, one, it's too expensive to do so, and two, some bigger stations buy programs and warehouse them, don't air them for years, if ever. It was our decision to not take on the financial burden and rather make the program available to everyone and anyone, anytime, anywhere in the world who might want to watch our series on demand. All you have to do is enter 11th and Grant with Eric Funk in your search engine, then choose from the list of all of our programs. We've won 9 Emmy Awards to date, and also a series of National Education Television Awards known as the NEDAs, even surpassing Austin City Limits for the last 4 years running as the best entertainment show in the U.S. regardless of market size. Here are some of the judges' comments from the NEDA conference a few years ago. Quote, "Easily one of the best music television programs I've seen. Everything from graphics to lighting to camera angles is first rate. Interestingly, the lack of an audience adds intimacy to the performance. Excellent program provides intimate concert for viewers while also giving insight to the band and their music. Great show open, very stylized and contemporary. Love the set and moody lighting. Very creative POV shots from the instruments. High-end production values on a small budget. Terrific interview segments and host. Obviously a tremendous amount of talent went into the production. And finally, the host's presence is felt throughout, even though you never see him during the piece. His intro and pedigree are clear, which makes this more than just a music show, but rather a very credible curation of artists. I wanted to watch it again," end quote. Out of the over 300 entries from across the country, only 29 stations were recognized that year, putting us in very good company. I asked the MFU students enrolled in my Enjoyment of Music course to choose and watch their choice of 48 of the 69 episodes of 11th and Grant and write comments on how effectively any particular group achieves the priorities of that particular genre showcased. This is, in part, a means to use the series as a vehicle to expose MSU students to a broad array of musical styles, while at the same time informing them of the differences. It changes how they listen and generally expands their listening pool to go far beyond that which they perhaps preferred to listen to in their lives to date. As the artistic director and host for 11th and Grant, my job is to find the talent and secure them for the season. The musicians are not paid. This is a means through which to provide them with a unique opportunity to present them through a one-hour program with high production values that reveals everything there is to know about the musicians in the group. All questions are answered. This is particularly valuable when any musician or group is trying to use proactive target marketing strategies, press kits, or to simply secure work. As host for the program, I interview the musicians to afford us a ratio of 45 to 15 in each show, meaning 45 minutes of music and 15 minutes of interview. The interviews aren't technical or about music per se, but rather a vehicle through which I can reveal and showcase personality and affect, character and integrity of the artists appearing on the series. Our audience is the television viewing audience. I intentionally pushed back against the idea of a live audience simply because Montanans can be facially stoic when listening to music, unless they're dancing. There is little value in cutting away for audience response when there isn't one visually present. And our studio is barely big enough to film the musicians present. Artists featured seem to have more nervousness about the interviews than they do about performing on the program. And they typically anxiously ask, what kinds of questions are you going to ask? Can you send us a list? I just explained that this is coffee in the kitchen conversation, Montana style. There aren't any formal questions. We're just going to talk. My objective is for the viewing audience to feel like they know these people after having watched an episode. It personalizes the program while dispelling myths about musicians and replacing them with the understanding that these are highly intelligent, sensitive, philosophical people with smart and deliberate intentions at play. Recently, we've been talking about the potential educational value of extracting just the interviews and making a separate set of programs. But like all great ideas, we're too small and too busy to undertake such a thing at this point. Everything's archived. We're moving forward. A few years ago, we shifted to filming every other year. We've always filmed an entire season back-to-back, five or six bands and five or six days in a row. It's intense, but logical in terms of the set, soundstage, light stage, camera operators, and other factors. It's basically one setup that shifted to accommodate specific needs instead of having to do that monthly. Beyond my work with Montana PBS TV as a presenter, I served as founding artistic director and host of the Big Sky Classical Music Festival in Big Sky. My job was at first to be the face of and the voice of the festival, but we quickly realized that the direction of the festival and the mission and goal statement of the festival needed to be better articulated. My duties thereby expanded to guiding the nature of the festival and the branding. In order to become one of the major musical festivals in the country, one of the expressed objectives, very specific ideologies needed to be at play and effectively realized. It can't be duplicative. It must be unique. Otherwise, it's just another festival. It's well on its way now to becoming that. I now enjoy being designated Emeritus Artistic Director. After some serious health issues forced me to step aside from my duties, my circumstance forced the decision to pass on my duties of Artistic Director and Host to the person I had been grooming to take over the position, Angela Ahn. That mentoring process was to have happened over a five-year period. To Angela's surprise and shock, she had to rather suddenly take over those responsibilities. While I remained available as needed in the wings for advice, guidance, and whatever assistance I could provide, the full responsibility truly fell entirely on her. Angela's celebrated reputation and subsequent connections with rising star musicians, the result of her own majestic stature in the music world, has been a major boon to the festival and the artists featured in that concert series and educational outreach. She's terrific and a perfect fit for this post, in spite of her exceptionally busy touring schedule and teaching duties at Montana State. In summary, so as you've just heard, my life as a musician has been varied, rich, and alive with opportunity. I don't think it could be any other way, honestly. Music isn't something I do. Music is something I am. When I did the interview for the Charles Osgood Sunday Morning CBS TV show, Martha Teichner asked me at one point, "Why are you living here in Montana? Why don't you choose to live in New York or London or Paris?" I replied, "I make sense here. Montana is my home. I'm 15 minutes from the airport and I need to go somewhere, and I get to come home to this after every trip." Musicians are classic introverts. I'm more of a misanthrope than my public persona suggests. This is a surprise to many folks, my public persona, large and outgoing. But the truth is, I adore being alone. I spend most of my life quite inward turned, listening to the music within and determining whether it belongs out here on the earth. Some pieces are too delicate, too personal to manifest on this plane. I'll keep those to myself. Some are, however, of vital importance. Such is the case with my pentalogy, Beyond Time. This six-hour cycle of five symphonic works is about human life on earth and involves my large work for tenor voice and orchestra, The Sojourner's Eye, Opus 100, regarding one man's journey from birth to death. My Symphony No. 6, Opus 88, Apocalypse, Phoenix Rising. Symphony No. 7, Opus 105, Time. Symphony No. 8, Opus 108, and Humankind Departed, regarding the post-Anthropocene era. And Symphony No. 9, Opus 111, Time Bridge to Beyond Time. The Ninth Symphony is an optimistic view that the earth is incomplete without human beings. I have them returning, but with a necessarily deeper consciousness into their impact on the earth. You can view excerpts of this on MSU YouTube under the name Beyond Time, a presentation I did in conjunction with the International XRTT Solar Physics Conference in 2010. The work I do as a musician in every aspect of my life is mainly giving back, sharing that to which I have access and hopefully an ability to share with others. I've worked hard and continue to do so, honing my art and craft as a composer and teacher and conductor and performer and presenter. While I do all these things as well as I can, composition is my lifeblood, and that will be my autobiography. I don't really believe that my story could be expressed any better than through my music. It's what I have created, that which I tend to leave behind. My teachers were powerfully deep. Inadvertently, they taught me to teach. They taught me how to build art with no life expectancy, music that can ideally live forever. It remains to be seen whether musicians in the future will insist upon playing it, hence keep it alive, and toward that end, it's been created to withstand the test of time. We'll see how that works out. In the meantime, I'm honored to work alongside my most amazing colleagues in the School of Music, many of whom have programmed and performed my music over the years here. I hold them each in such high respect. It's the best music faculty by far in Montana, and certainly the finest I've worked with in my 45 years of teaching. I'd like to close by going back to the piano, end tonight's lecture with a short performance. Every jazz piano player has a tune that they play when they sit down at the piano. It shifts over time, but there's usually just one that comes to mind for each of us for any given period. My go-to song used to be Laura, the title track for the 1943 Hollywood movie directed by Otto Preminger starring Gene Tierney. But it shifted a few years ago to the one I'll play for you now, The Nearness of You by Hoagy Carmichael and Ned Washington. It's interesting to note as a sidebar that the chord progression is exactly the same as that which Errol Garner uses for his song Misty. I'll see if I can insert it so you can hear how it fits. Everything but the bridge is the same. Before I head to the piano, I'd just like to say thanks for listening.